Partly sunny and warm. Saturday's high 73 inland, 68 near Lake Michigan. Sunday, a chance of rain in the morning. Rain likely in the afternoon with a high of 69. And then it looks like a rainy Memorial Day. Cloudy, rainy, and warm with a high of 76. Right now, wind from the northeast at 5. Not a bad morning. 48 degrees, Kenosha and Racine. 44 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Coming up on today's program, a look back 50 years to two controversial tragic deaths, two murders, which helped spark passage of the Voting Rights Act. Before we get to that, just a quick word about some of the interesting morning shows that are coming up over the next few days. There'll be no morning show on Monday because of Memorial Day. On Tuesday, you'll hear the conversation which I recorded with Dr. Sue Savaglio Jarvis, who is the superintendent of the Kenosha Unified School District. You can hear our wide-ranging conversation on a number of topics related to the school district. On Wednesday, the very intriguing story of the man who invented the Polaroid camera. If you are of a certain age, you certainly vividly remember the Polaroid camera, which revolutionized the whole notion of what it meant to take pictures and to see them. Rather than taking your film and sending it off for processing, you would have in a matter of 1 minute or so, the result of the picture which you had just taken. It reshaped everything, but it also sparked fierce competition and a savagely fought patent war in the courts. And that's all explored in a really interesting new book called A Touch of Genius, which we'll talk about on Wednesday's morning show. On Thursday, I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios Kate Jerome, who is in the horticulture program here at Gateway Technical College. And as many of you know, Kate Jerome is a frequent guest to the morning show here to answer questions about lawn and garden care. So we'll open up our phone lines for your questions next Thursday. And a week from today, I'll be airing an interview, which I'm planning to record next week, an interview I plan to record at the Kenosha Theater. And that, of course, is the spectacular space on the south end of downtown Kenosha, which was a sparkling jewel for many, many years. Opened in the late 1920s, it closed in the early 1960s, primarily a movie house, but also a space in which all kinds of live entertainment was presented to the community. It is, of course, been dormant many, many years, but there is a dedicated group of volunteers who hope that the Kenosha Theater can still someday be restored. I saw it with my own eyes for the first time just a couple of days ago and have arranged for a return visit with recorder in hand. And the plan is to share that interview with you on next Friday, the 29th. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived at our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Today's interview was recorded. Many Americans know of Bloody Sunday, March 7th, 1965, a very, very important moment in the civil rights era, as Americans saw on their televisions the unbelievably disturbing sight of state troopers attacking unarmed, peaceful demonstrators as they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. It was really the outrage fueled by those images that really moved events along towards the passage of the long-needed Voting Rights Act. What is sometimes neglected in telling this story is of the events that immediately preceded that day in March, which involved two different murders, one of a man by the name of Jimmy Lee Jackson, and the other the murder of a clergyman from the North by the name of James Reeb. And those stories, again, so often either untold or undertold, are explored in careful detail in a really fascinating book called Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. I'll be speaking with one of the book's co-authors, Adar Cohen, who is an educator, organizer, and researcher in the field of conflict resolution and nonviolent social change. He teaches in the Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies Department at DePaul University, right down to the south of us in Chicago. And I'm very pleased to be able to speak with him about his very, very interesting book, co-written with Steve Pfeiffer, published by Reagan Arts. Again, it's titled Jimmy Lee and James. Adar Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks so much for having me.
I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. At the author's note at the very front of the book, you talk about how the two of you traveled down to Selma, Montgomery, and nearby Marion to try to explore exactly what events ensued 50 years ago. And you actually, in fact, were able to speak to a number of people either involved or who were witnesses or who in one way or another were very directly, tangibly involved in some of these events. Just talk for a moment about that process and maybe the difficulty as well when various people for various reasons have conflicting accounts of exactly what occurred.
Yeah, Greg, it was fascinating because, first of all, it's hard to earn trust. Folks who were involved in the civil rights movement, from the movement leaders all the way down to the foot soldiers, who most of the time carried the day, they are suspicious and sometimes not trusting of journalists and writers who once again want to chronicle the civil rights movement and are maybe going to spin the tale to their own advantage according to an agenda. So to begin with, we had the task of earning people's trust, and that involved just sitting with folks, spending time with them, being in conversation about then and about now. And once we were able to earn that trust, I had some fascinating discussions with movement leaders, and also some group conversations, some group discussions that allowed folks to do some remembering together, which actually, in the end, became very, I think, restorative and useful to them as well, because they were able to reckon with some of the past and square it with what they were experiencing today and what they saw today throughout the country. The whole process was, it was a privilege for me to be in conversation with those folks. And yes, we did have to sometimes reconcile conflicting accounts. I mean, this is 50 years ago now. Some people's accounts were different the day after some of these events, all the way back in 1965, so it's no surprise that 50 years later, you'll get just as much disagreement. We did our best to reconcile conflicting accounts, you know, using primary source materials and doing the work of obtaining FBI files and other papers and books and doing a lot of interviews.
I wonder if you could specifically talk about the experience of speaking with those who, in a sense, would you would on a personal or at least political level very much consider to be adversaries. That is, those that I guess if we want to be really kind of rude or crude about it, we would describe as the bad guys in this chapter of our history. I mean, those not at all sympathetic to the civil rights movement. I mean, at least then, maybe more appreciative of it now. But I assume that you had encounters with people like that, or at least wanted to, in order to tell this story as completely as possible. Mm-hmm. Could you just say a word about if, in fact, those kind of encounters and in interviews occurred, and if so, what they were like? And this, when you speak about trying to gain someone's trust in order to have them share freely with you, what does that mean when we're talking about someone who was perhaps a former member of the Ku Klux Klan or in some other way a participant on that side of this divide?
Well, I think what was chilling was that their responses, the responses of segregationists, adversaries of the movement back then, were almost as firmly oppositional and resistant to change as they were 50 years ago. So really, in most cases, adversaries to the movement went on record back then and didn't have much more to say today. There's an interesting part of what our book deals with is the charges brought against the state trooper James Bernard Fowler, who shot the unarmed peaceful protester Jimmie Lee Jackson during a melee that the police created at a nighttime vigil. And our book chronicles the bringing to justice of Trooper Fowler 40 years after the killing. And in many ways, that public reckoning with the past was restorative and brought about some closure for folks in Marion, Alabama. But on another level, the half-hearted apology and the equivocation really actually just seemed to extend the talking points of segregationists from that period.
Hmm. You, again, do focus on that beginning with the prologue of the book, and we meet this relatively young DA by the name of Michael Jackson, absolutely no relation to Jimmie Lee Jackson, one of the two men shot that you chronicle in the book. But you mention the fact that he was 1 year old when Jimmie Lee Jackson was shot. So in a sense, he is wrestling with something about which he had no direct encounter or memory of, and yet, of course, he and others were very much living with the legacy of what happened to Jimmie Lee Jackson.
Yeah, in fact, as an African-American district attorney, he was all too aware that his station and the achievements that he had reached were very much owed to Jimmie Lee Jackson and other martyrs and leaders in the struggle. So in my conversations with D.A. Jackson, I could sense the weight on his shoulders, the weight of history, and also his passion to carry forward the social justice and equal rights agenda of his forebears.
We're speaking with Adar Cohen, who is one of two authors of a book called Jimmie Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. In chapter one of the book, you help set the scene by really helping us understand the extent to which a Voting Rights Act was so necessary, particularly in a place like Alabama. Just ahead of that, I wonder if you would just say a word about the Civil Rights Act, which had been passed in 1964, as most Americans know, and which, of course, instigated some important changes. And I think probably in the minds of many, blacks and whites alike, maybe the thought or the hope was that that would be the signal of a wonderful new era of peace and freedom and opportunity for blacks.
Yeah.
And, of course, the job was by no means, in fact, finished.
I think, Yeah, I think the lesson of the lesson here is that, you know, we, in some ways, we could hope that the Civil War had resolved the question, that the Constitution of the United States had resolved the question of equal participation and equal rights. The lesson here is that the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, these are milestones, but they are not. They bring no guarantee. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down a crucial provision of the Voting Rights Act, which was so hard fought and hard won in 1965. I mean, literally years in the making, and required at great cost to those who struggled for it. That in 2013, we are able to we witnessed the obliteration of preclearance provisions that would protect voting rights in the areas where areas of the country where there have been the most highest number and the most egregious incursions on minorities' voting rights is troubling. And what we saw immediately in the wake of the 2013 Supreme Court decision were swift and creative measures undertaken to change laws, to introduce voter ID laws, to redistrict according to minority demographics, to change the location of polling places. You know, this battle was fought and won, and unfortunately, it requires ongoing participation for us to protect this most important feature of our democracy. Hmm.
I like the choice that you and your co-author made of intensely personalizing this situation in Alabama by having us, in a sense, experience it through the eyes of one person in particular, a woman by the name of Willie Nell Avery, one of who knows how many blacks trying to secure the right to vote in Marion. Just say a word about that choice and about her situation.
So courageous. These are folks who are, at the time, living, to say living paycheck to paycheck would understate it. They're living really at the whim of the white power structure. And to put yourself on the line to go and register to vote not only opens you up for ridicule and mockery at the registrar, where you might be asked obscure questions about the state constitution or how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap to disqualify you from voting, with what they called a literacy test, but was really just an elaborate system of hurdles. They faced those challenges, but perhaps more devastating was the threat and intimidation that they faced when they went to attempt to register to vote. So folks lost their jobs. They were run off of the farms that they had worked for so long. And there was the very real intimidation, threats of violence, and the use of violence to frighten African Americans away from the ballot. Hmm. And folks like Willie Nell Avery, I mean, I was so privileged to have conversations with her and to hear from her firsthand at just the depth of her pain at being so systematically cut out of the democratic process and what that what kind of resolve that led to, and how she was really willing to sacrifice her own safety in order to achieve the right to vote, to participate fully in her democracy.
I thought one thing she said that is important to note is Avery knows that whites in town can be cordial to blacks, willing to accept their status as second-class citizens, but not those who challenged the power structure. In other words, for somebody from the outside looking in, they might see what appears to be a relatively idyllic situation,
right?
A society in which people nod and smile and say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, and so on. But just beneath that very polite, even genteel surface, there, in fact, is terrible injustice,
right?
And that if anybody disturbs that idyllic surface bit of theater, that's when this hate really begins to make itself known.
And that's what happened in Selma when Reverend Reeb responded to Dr. King's call to clergy to flood Selma with support. Here comes a white minister from Boston, supportive of the cause. And, you know, three segregationists from Selma killed him on the street in his first moments in the city. The threat of so-called outside agitators, particularly when white clergy and white activists came, so undermined the system of racial superiority, of white superiority, that the reaction to that was very dramatic. And it should have been, according to the segregationists' agenda, because it was a very provocative and revealing endeavor that whites and blacks suddenly were meeting on an ongoing basis, conducting workshops in nonviolence in the church basements, planning during mass meetings in the worship center, in the worship area of the church, doing all of the strategic work. It was very time intensive and required them to walk side by side and to be in partnership and to actually probably disagree and compromise and work together. That became a microcosm, whites and blacks working together for this cause, a microcosm of what promise the movement held. So in a sense, they were doing a social experiment of what could be possible for society at large. And that was very positive for the movement because it gave them hope. It gave them a model to strive for. But it was very, very threatening to the white power structure in the South, particularly those southern cities that became civil rights battlegrounds like Selma.
I'm just curious, and I especially am curious, given your long background in terms of what issues have been most important to you. Did you find yourself through the course of researching this book developing any new understanding and perhaps even a little bit of sympathy for some of those Southern whites who found the developments of the late 50s, early 60s so bewildering and even frightening? I mean, shaking the very ground beneath their feet in terms of such dramatic change. And of course, now in retrospect, it feels to us like nothing was changing at all, or not changing nearly fast enough. But for some of those whites, at least, it was as though their whole universe was threatened, all which they had known and understood and cherished. On at least some kind of level, do you feel like you have come to understand their mindset, even if you can't obviously agree with it?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Earlier you used the word sympathy for their mindset, which is, I think, something that I have not achieved. But understanding of their mindset, maybe. In a way, to continue to examine this period and to look so closely at the lives and deaths of Jimmie Lee Jackson and James Reeb, it really requires some kind of moral imagination on the part of the researcher and the writer. And Steve and I think, I'll speak for myself, I really had to at times hang my hat on just the hope or the speculation that I really have to think that in his heart of hearts, at night when he was at home, hopefully laying awake in bed, you know, evaluating what he had done that day, that Sheriff Jim Clark had his doubts. That his course was the right one, and other white segregationists who held the system of Jim Crow in place. I have to hope, or at least wonder, that they had their doubts and that they had their moments of uncertainty and soul searching. Otherwise they become one dimensional characters and very, very difficult to sympathize with at all.
Hmm. At some point in the book, you quote a Southern newspaper. I don't remember now which one it is. I don't have it right in front of me, but you quote a newspaper account. We're slightly jumping ahead here, but I only want to make the point about what you were just saying. A newspaper which tended to publish extremely critical editorials about Dr. King. But in this case, this particular newspaper, we assume operated and owned by whites, spoke out pretty forcefully against some of the violence which erupted, which your book talks about, even while also managing to kind of slap some criticism at Dr. King. But I was really struck by that because I think most of us, when we look back at this era, really tend to, in a sense, segregate people to one side of the divide or the other. And we don't think very much about persons or entities that perhaps in some ways found themselves caught in the middle.
Interesting. You know, this to me, this is the power of of a nonviolent campaign and of adhering to the strategies and principles of nonviolence as embodied by Dr. King and by leaders of SNCC and of SCLC during the movement. A nonviolent posture and a coordinated, coherent, strict adherence to nonviolence is a pretty sure bet to win over anyone in that middle ground that you're describing, Greg. And I think that's the lesson I hope that folks can draw from our book as we see protests across the country, some of them much more productive than others, that the application of some of these nonviolent methods is not simply coming out of a passive, non-aggressive posture, but that this really has to do with a political calculation that you will win over a larger cross-section of society if you adhere to this approach. And I think there's tremendous potential here today, particularly with the new potential in social media. I mean, the social media capabilities of today, they just far outpace what the civil rights leaders had at their disposal, and yet their ability to stay on message and to carefully craft a media message that consistently portrayed the civil rights activists as disciplined and principled and patient was something that really won over those moderates, and I think won the hearts and minds of Americans over the course of the struggle.
We're speaking with Adar Cohen, the co-author of a book called Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. Do you have time for a few more questions?
I do.
Thank you. So we bring ourselves to February 18th, 1965. Explain to our listeners the meeting which was taking place that evening.
There was a meeting in Zion United Church in Marion. Just as the dramatic events in Selma were unfolding in nearby Marion, Alabama, there was an intense push for the right to vote for African Americans there, and activists there were interested in holding a nighttime march, a night vigil, to protest the arrest of one of their beloved leaders, James Orange, who was being held in jail. And there had been rumors that he would be lynched or harmed in some way that evening. So activists were undertaking a peaceful demonstration. And as they emerged from the church, it was clear that there was a coordinated effort on the part of law enforcement, who were supported by local ruffians who had been deputized by the police, and these demonstrators were brutally attacked, and the city lights were cut so that the streets were totally dark, and a great amount of brutality followed. Demonstrators were certainly the brunt of that abuse, but also the journalists covering Marion at that time were beaten badly and had their cameras spray painted with black paint so that images of the violence couldn't be captured. In that melee, Jimmy Lee Jackson, a a young church deacon and farmer and woodcutter who had attempted to register to vote half a dozen times himself, was shot in the stomach by a state trooper.
This occurs in something called Max Cafe, and I appreciate the fact that you examine this as closely as you possibly can. That being said, it's very clear that it is ultimately unclear just exactly what happened. And I should think that for you and your co-author, you perhaps went in hoping that by the end of it, it would really be clearly discernible what in fact happened. Just explain the level of uncertainty that surrounds this.
Yeah, the day after the violence in Max Cafe, there were conflicting accounts. So it's no surprise that 50 years later, there are conflicting accounts. You do your best to reconcile them and to do the most responsible job you can as a journalist, as a writer. We were able to uncover some testimonies taken by the FBI immediately after the attack that were revelatory and confirmed many, many facets of a particular angle on the story. And we did our best to validate those with interviews and looking at other resources.
As you are describing this, it's interesting to see the description you share of, for instance, Sheriff Jim Clark and Chief T.O. Harris. Mm. And they are, in a sense, two different faces of the white establishment. And not that they're poles apart, far from it. But I think the contrast between them is really fascinating. Could you just say a word about that?
Well, in T.O. Harris, you had the so-called moderate. And you know, by today's standards, we wouldn't bestow such a label as moderate. But in that era, he was the picture of moderation, whereas Sheriff Jim Clark was the ardent and very fiery segregationist who swung his club freely and wore a lapel pin that said never, which was his stand on integration. In some ways, what's interesting about this is how the movement engages these two characters or these two types of, protectors of Jim Crow system. Selma was not chosen randomly as the battleground. SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which Dr. King led, they chose Selma because of Jim Clark. They wanted and needed a nemesis like that, who could be counted on for horrible outbursts, who could be counted on to crudely shove people off of the courthouse steps as they attempted to register to vote. They needed those images, and they needed that. They needed to tell that story to the whole nation. With T.O. Harris and with other more moderate law enforcement officials and mayors and the like, a less dramatic showdown, it doesn't have the same return for the movement, which really needs to win the sympathy of the majority and relies on folks like Sheriff Clark for their outbursts to reveal all that's underneath the system of racial segregation. Because for white Northerners, for example, they're very much removed from voting disenfranchisement in 1965. They need to see something dramatic to capture their attention. They need to have their viewing of judgment at Nuremberg on March 7th at 9:30 in the evening. 50 million Americans, almost 50 million, are watching Judgment at Nuremberg, which is the great reckoning with Nazi atrocities. ABC cuts away from that film to show American law enforcement officers raining terror down on peaceful protesters from horseback, shooting tear gas, whips, clubs. The public needed those kinds of images to capture and hold their attention and to stir their moral imagination. And it just wasn't going to happen by dealing with moderate law enforcement. They needed Jim Clark.
As some of our listeners might recall, Jimmie Lee Jackson did not die instantly from those gunshot wounds. It was days later, actually, before he died in the hospital. Was there immediate and significant reaction to his shooting while he was still alive, or was it only upon his death that there was really significant outcry and reaction?
Certainly there was a reaction immediately following his shooting, but as we can imagine, it reached a new level when he died of those injuries. But one critique at the time of the nation's response to both Jimmie Lee Jackson's death and Reverend Reeb's death from President Johnson on down was that the response to Reverend Reeb's death was framed as, you know, the most horrible instance of violence, and it really seemed to completely overshadow Jimmie Lee Jackson's death just 2 weeks earlier. And this was a sticking point for African Americans who rightfully continued to experience a kind of privileging of white lives over their own. There were some very interesting comments made along those lines during the struggle.
And by the way, I found the newspaper passage that I was talking about earlier when I mentioned certain persons, certain entities who in some ways were sort of caught in the middle. This is the Montgomery Advertiser. Mm-hmm. You say, no friend of Martin Luther King Jr. and SCLC taking issue with statements made by both the sheriff or the mayor. Here's what they say, that is the newspaper. What happened in Marion last night was a nightmare of state police stupidity and brutality. The Marion massacre, let's not hear apologies or denials for this horror. The state is sick and tired of King and his sensation-seeking campaign, but that does nothing to excuse the terrible night in Marion. It cannot be explained away by excuses because of outside agitators or provocation, which was present. It is the inside agitators in uniform who have disgraced Alabama. Hmm. I mean, it's intriguing to read an editorial like that. And of course, it's in a sense encouraging for a newspaper like the Montgomery Advertiser to speak out as forcefully as that, it seems to me.
And I think that's part of the lesson for today. We can learn a lot from the movement and from the architects of the civil rights movement who bet on the power of nonviolence to win over the sympathy of the majority. And that's why they stuck to it, and I think that it paid off in the end. Today's strife in lots of cities across the country, you know, the activists who are seeking to interrupt patterns of unconstitutional and violent policing, for example, they might meet much more success and much more buy-in from the American public if they took some pages out of the Civil Rights Manual.
Hmm. The other person for whom we need to speak about, at least briefly, is this clergyman by the name of James Reeb. And what a fascinating person he is. And I feel like until your book was written, his own intriguing background has never been this deeply explored. Ahead of doing research on this book, did you know very much about him beyond his name?
Very little, and that's true for me and also for my co-author Steve Pfeiffer. We knew very, very little about James Reeb.
Tell our listeners who he was in the sense of where he came from.
Reeb is a fascinating individual who undertakes a complex journey that involves a theological and spiritual evolution that ultimately lands him with the Unitarians and working as an organizer, an activist in the Tough Roxbury section of Boston, where he becomes an advocate for fair housing and generally an advocate for equal rights for African Americans in Boston, and really dedicates his ministry to this kind of organizing. And it's when Dr. King issues that call to clergy in the aftermath of Bloody Sunday that Reeb, in typical form, searches his soul to understand what is his moral responsibility in this particular situation. And despite a really reluctant partner at home, his wife Marie, and young children who needed him, and folks in the Boston community who relied on him, he determined that he couldn't not go, and so he went to Selma.
I appreciate so much the elegance and eloquence of his rhetoric. You include a number of excerpts from various things that he wrote, including something that he writes apparently in the wake of deciding to leave the Presbyterian ministry. He writes that he realized that he was much more of a humanist than a deist or a theist, and his goal from that point was to inspire people to noble and courageous living. We just don't hear people talking in those kind of terms very often about what they want their life to amount to and when what they want to do in terms of making a difference in the world.
And when we do hear them talk like that, Greg, nowadays, it's even less frequently that we see them act that way. And I think that what we had in Reverend Reeb was a minister and an activist who was ready to back up his words and make difficult decisions.
I especially appreciate how you quote his very final sermon, that is Reverend Reeb. And what is striking to me is the way in which he seems to really have his finger on the pulse of the civil rights movement, and not just the very important central principles, but also certain practical matters and the reality of what a difficult fight, in fact, it is. At one point in this sermon, he says, "We must not let the backlash, as it were, increase, because we continue to see that Negroes do what people call push. There is going to be even greater pressure for more progress, for now the Negro knows that there is only injustice that stands between him and a better way of life." I mean, that last part's really beautiful, but I'm struck by the fact that he is well aware of this idea of backlash as well, that that the civil rights movement runs this risk of, in the minds of some, pushing too hard or pushing too fast or crossing certain lines. And he's saying, so be it. That line has to be crossed.
Yeah, and that was the this was the idea shared by all the factions within the civil rights movement, I think, from SNCC to SCLC to CORE to the NAACP, that we really needed to push, and that it was time to dramatize these grievances. And that couldn't be done comfortably anymore. It couldn't be done conveniently anymore. It couldn't be done according to the schedule or preferences of power holders anymore, but that it was time to force the issue. And that was what was that's what enabled activists to dramatize their grievances and to bring to light the injustices that they were experiencing. They needed to push the issue.
Briefly, tell us about March 9th, 1965, and what happens to Reverend James Reeb.
Reverend Reeb has come to Selma, and there is a mass meeting is happening in Brown Chapel. Dr. King is leading the meetings, and he releases everyone to have dinner. And with two of his minister colleagues, James Reeb seeks out a place to have dinner, and actually they opt to eat in the black restaurant near the chapel. After dinner, they're heading back to the church for further instructions from King. And just outside of the restaurant are attacked by white segregationists who cross the street and come up behind them. One of them swings a metal pipe or a club and strikes Reeb in the temple, sending him to the ground. And he dies of his injuries later.
This chapter 6, begins so poignantly with these words. Who knows what would have happened if James Reeb, Clark Olson, and Orloff Miller had returned to Brown Chapel the same way they had come? I mean, it may have been as simple a choice as left versus right, which in fact led them to what was this ultimately deadly encounter. Briefly, can you just contrast the reaction to the murder of Reverend Reeb to that of Jimmie Lee Jackson? In what way, if there are significant ways, was it a different reaction? In what way was this kind of murder perceived as something different?
President Johnson got involved when Reeb was killed, and that didn't happen when Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed. There was a national outcry, protests around the country. I think the Boston Philharmonic changed their program that night, and they performed Dance of the Blessed Spirits. There were marches, sympathy marches, all over the country, which was a beautiful thing on its own, but did cast a bit of a shadow on the reaction of the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson only 2 weeks earlier. But it's hard to completely regret the huge outpouring of support, because it was, as we chronicle in the book, a great driving force toward the passage of the Voting Rights Act. Reeb's death certainly galvanized the momentum of the movement and really captured people's attention.
Well, your book goes on to chronicle just exactly the scope of the reaction to both of these murders and to what ensues, including, of course, ultimately the passing of a Voting Rights Act and the pursuit of justice in terms of the murderer of Jimmie Lee Jackson. And that in and of itself is a really fascinating story, which we'll leave to our listeners to explore as they read your book as I did. Jimmie Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. It is published by Regan Arts, and one of the authors, Adar Cohen. Adar Cohen, thank you so much for writing such a powerful and important book, and I am so glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank
you. Greg, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
A reminder that Monday on The Morning Show, we will not have a program because of Memorial Day, but on Tuesday's program, Dr. Sue Savaglio-Jarvis, the superintendent of the Kenosha Unified School District, will have the president of the Kenosha Unified School Board with us as well. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. Our weather forecast is for quite a lovely day, actually. Sunny and mild conditions with a high range.